Welcome to the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Turk. Join me as we dive into the personal stories of some of the world's best hospitality professionals. We follow the journey of their ups, downs, and wild turns to find out what it truly takes to make it in the amazing world of hospitality. Listener, if you're running a hospitality business, you already know the work doesn't stop. And most of the time, it's not even the guests that wear you out. It's everything happening behind the scenes. That's why I'm really glad to introduce you to Lodgify, our sponsor for this episode. Lodgify is an all-in-one platform that helps short-term rental hosts and hospitality operators stay organized without needing a dozen different tools. You can manage reservations, keep your calendars synced, communicate with guests, and even collect payments all in one place. And if part of your goal this year is to drive more direct bookings, Lodgify also makes it easy to build your own website so guests can book directly with you. Plus, and I love this one, they include free onboarding so you're not figuring everything out on your own. If you like to spend less time managing the chaos and more time focused on hospitality, try Lodgify with a 20% discount on all their yearly and bi-yearly plans with our code THM20. And that's THM20. Now, back to the show. Welcome to another episode of the Hospitality Mentor Podcast. And today, listeners, I'm very excited. I got Dara McGillicuddy joining us. He is the founder of McGillicuddy Hospitality. Dara, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a real honor to be here.
But Dara, why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners here before we jump in? Tell us about who you are and what your company does.
Absolutely. I think my name gives away where I come from. I'm an Irishman, but now more of a global citizen living outside of Ireland since I was 18 years old. And I'm currently the founder and managing director of a company called McGillicuddy Hospitality. We're all about developing the next leaders in hospitality, the next generation of leaders. That business is now 17 years old this year. Started in 2008. I'm based in Cape Town, South Africa, although often on the road. And as you know, joining you from Miami today. Yeah, and just excited to be here and exchange some ideas with you today.
I love it, Dara. Well, we always start every podcast the same way. What was your very first job in hospitality?
Good question. My first job, I should preempt this by saying that child labor laws were not applicable back then because I was 11 years old. I'm not sure it was legal for me to be working. And maybe not a traditional first hospitality job, but my job was to cut the grass at our family business, which is a hotel that was founded in 1958 in Ireland. That's called Ballygarry House, or currently known as the Estate at Ballygarry. And my first job was to cut the grass. I was kind of the head of landscaping, I like to think of it as. It was a great opportunity to be out in the fresh air. I remember there was a time when we upgraded to one of those tractor mowers, so that made my life so much easier.
Yeah.
And actually, my first aha from that experience was I used to watch these rental cars pull up into the hotel's car park, particularly those ones with the little number one on it. So Hertz back then used to have these little stickers on their rental cars, so they were quite easy to identify. And we would have these guests, often American guests, jump out of these cars, and I would see them struggle with their suitcase. So my dad had told me that, you know, if you see somebody that looks like they need help, go and help them. And I would do that. And I learned very quickly that if you just brought their suitcases to the room, suddenly they were putting $5, $10 in your hand. And 11 years old, that was a lot of money back then, right? So I think we're talking 1984. So yeah, it was maybe one of my first lessons in hospitality is it looks like they need help. Take care of them. And you know, the rewards are sometimes unanticipated, but always useful.
And where to start? That's an amazing way to start the career. So I didn't know that about you. So your family owned this hotel, and was it a hotel that you lived in, or was it something that your father owned and it wasn't something you had to do? What was that like for you?
Yeah, my grandfather actually was a kind of a property developer. He bought this old, beautiful old house just outside of a town called Tralee. And he saw it as an opportunity based on location to create what was a small hotel at the time. That was 1958. My father took over the business, having returned from training in London and Switzerland. And then he ran the business and grew the business quite a lot for about, 20 years, at which point my brother took over the business. And my brother has now been managing the hotel very successfully for about 22 years, if I've got my numbers right. Ballygarry is a 4-star estate hotel. My brother has purchased all of the land around the hotel and has rewilded the land, which means returning it from farmland back to its natural habitat. It's amazing. He's been on a sustainability mission, so the hotel is now carbon neutral. He's very proud to say, and he'd kill me if I didn't mention it here. And yeah, I'm very proud of him because he's done an amazing job with that hotel. It's typically in the top 10 hotels in Ireland, and there are roughly 1,000 hotels operating in Ireland right now. And so that puts him in the top 1%. And that's both on TripAdvisor, but also these top 100 lists that get published by the Irish media and so on. So he's punching above his weight. He's up there with the big names like Adair Manor, Dromoland Castle, Ashford Castle, the Shelburne, and so on. And it's great to see him doing so well. He's really reimagined the property into something quite unique. His most recent venture has been to add some cabins, some eco cabins on the estate, where you're really living in nature, but you have all the services of the hotel right there. And that's just taking off. He went live with that project in June of this year, and he's already selling out on weekends and so on. So it's been an amazing journey for him.
Yeah, give the name of the hotel one more time, because it is beautiful. We talked about it last time.
So yes, it's the estate at Ballygarry. The website is ballygarry.com, ballygarry.com. And yeah, it's kind of one of those places you could park your car on a Friday night and easily leave it there for the weekend and just enjoy nature, enjoy everything the hotel has to offer. Yeah, very, very proud of how far the business has come under his leadership. And actually, tomorrow I'll be meeting with my nephew, who is currently in training with the Dorchester in London, and he's beginning his journey to eventually take over the business, so that will make him the 4th generation. And ironically, his name is Owen and my dad's name was Owen. So, you know, it seems like a full circle moment. So we're excited to see him build his career. He's going to go study in Lausanne. He's going to do a number of things to prepare him for that and eventually take over the reins at Ballygarry.
I love hearing that. It's amazing to see all of this and how you're going. So you were growing up in this hotel.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of people would say, oh, I love the hotel business. And we're like, oh my God, this is my family's business. I don't want to do it. But it seems like on paper, you went to Shannon College of Hotel Management. So you're like, all right, I'm going to go do this. Or was it just like, I don't know what else to do? How did that happen?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, you asked the question, did we live in the hotel? We actually moved out of the hotel right before I was born. My sister always makes fun. She says, you know, we had to get a house when you came along because, you know, but we lived in a wing of the hotel. So, yeah. So growing up in a hotel is, of course, unique, right? It's in good and bad ways. I mean, you have access to a kitchen that's pretty much operating 24/7 and people preparing food. So that's a real luxury to have. But it was an incredible upbringing because we got to, you know, really live in the business every day and experience it, you know, throughout my kind of teenage years when I really started getting involved in the business. You asked about Shannon. So Shannon College of Hotel Management is a boutique hotel school on the west coast of Ireland at Shannon Airport. Quite a prestigious school, has a great reputation around the world. And it came time for me to decide what I wanted to do as I was completing kind of my high school years. And I just felt like hospitality is in my blood and I would be, you know, disingenuous not to pursue that. And so I did. And I went to Shannon. I spent 4 years there. Two of those years were spent in industry. Actually, it's quite a unique setup in that you do a year of theory on site at the college for the first year. Your second year is on placement. I was working with Sheraton Hotels in Brussels for that year, which was, of course, an amazing experience. I was in the kitchen as a banquet chef. I was a waiter in a fine dining restaurant and among a number of other things. Then we came back to Shannon in the third year where we were, again, kind of working on more management theory at that stage. And then the fourth year was another placement year. And I found myself working in London in what was then the Kensington Post Hotel, a big hotel right off the high street in Kensington. And, you know, that kind of was the beginning of my career because as soon as I graduated, I was fortunate to be able to stay on with them. They wanted to keep me on full time. And I stayed there, I think it was 3 years before I had the opportunity to then move stateside and start working with Ritz-Carlton Hotels, which was kind of the next chapter of my career.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. So how did you decide to leave, right? Because you have your family hotel there, you're from Ireland. How do you decide, all right, I'm going to make a move and move to all places in Virginia, right? Is that where you...
That's right,
different worlds come out, problems.
100%. I think I was bitten by the travel bug because that first year where I went to Brussels, that was kind of the last time I really lived in Ireland. And it, you know, I haven't lived there since. And I just realized that, you know, I'm absolutely a very proud Irishman. I love to go back home. I still call it home. But I also realize that, gosh, there's a whole world out here to be explored. And I think our business lends itself to getting to travel the world, right? So being in hospitality, I wanted to take advantage of that. The opportunity came up to work with Ritz-Carlton in a leadership capacity. The first hotel I worked at with Ritz-Carlton was in just outside DC, so in Northern Virginia. It was the Ritz-Carlton Pentagon City. As the name implies, it's right next to the Pentagon. So quite a unique hotel to work in because we had all of the, you know, defense companies, Boeing and McDonnell Douglas, all of the kind of senior leadership that were coming in to obviously negotiate defense packages at the Pentagon were staying in our hotel. So those were our regulars. We also had quite a lot of celebrities staying in the hotel. We had NBA teams staying there. I have a great photo walking out the driveway with Michael Jordan and his father either side of me. Actually, I looked like they're my escort. You know, I was actually escorting him to the bus. Yeah. And of course, you know, a lot of political figures. I was like, you know, we hosted Yasser Arafat at the hotel when there was peace talks happening back then, you know, and we hosted a number of foreign dignitaries and you name it. So it was quite an interesting hotel. A lot of diplomacy, both, I guess, on the guest side and our side. We had to be quite diplomatic in how we managed those high profile guests. But it was the beginning of an amazing part of my career where I think it was quite a formative part of my career. Ritz-Carlton had a massive influence on me. You know, I was in my 20s. I had come from Ireland and the UK, and to come into the US market at this level was really something. Back then, the luxury sector of hospitality really only had two brands that were competing, and that was Four Seasons and then Ritz-Carlton. So to be part of that was incredible. Obviously, that market segment is now much more populated, right? It's a more crowded field for sure. But I eventually started doing hotel openings with Ritz-Carlton. I got to work in Shanghai, did a reflag of a Shangri-La hotel there, which was quite something to Ritz-Carlton. So one night at midnight, we lowered the Shangri-La flag and we raised the Ritz-Carlton flag. And I remember we had to chip up the logo out of the marble at the front door of the hotel and replace it with a Ritz-Carlton lion, of course. And yeah, so I had the opportunity to try to train people on the Ritz-Carlton culture, and to do that in the US was one thing. People got really excited about that, but to do that in China, mainland China, 1998 was quite a different thing. It was, you know, you were speaking a language, not just language barrier, but speaking about empowerment and kind of a really employee-led culture that just wasn't common at the time. So I took a lot of lessons from that experience. And then when I came back from that, I did a couple more openings in the US. New Orleans is the one that sticks in my memory as a very challenging property to open for a number of reasons. But I found myself eventually working at the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead, Atlanta. And at the time, that was where Ritz-Carlton were headquartered. This was pre-Marriott acquisition. Right around the time, in fact, that I think the discussions had begun. So I was in the unique position of working in a building in a hotel attached to the corporate office. And that meant great exposure. It, you know, it meant that you were kind of right in the thick of the action at all times. It also meant that the CEO was parking on my driveway every morning and walking through my lobby every morning. And yeah, that was pressure. You know, Horst Schulze was the founder, of course, and the CEO or chairman at the time. And what an amazing man. But to have the opportunity to see him on a daily basis and just chat to him, he's a remarkable human. And I was just honored for that. But also, it allowed me to be the kind of lab environment or the testing ground. So, you know, if they had a new product that they wanted to test or a new service procedure, new service standard they wanted to test, we were often the hotel that would try those things out. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that happened to shape what I ended up doing for a living in terms of what our business does today. It led me to really crystallizing what service needs to look like for a brand to be world-class. And, you know, often we don't realize we're being trained on something, right? Or when we're learning something, it's a reflection, right? But yeah, that was an incredible opportunity because I felt like I got to play a small part in shaping the standards of one of the world's leading hospitality brands.
So I want to touch on that because there's so many books and people are always looking, that's the gold standard. Everyone that worked for Ritz-Carlton, I was always secretly a little jealous. They all had their credo card and they had secret language that they all had together. And this would be poor Mary, I bought it, which is it's different now than what it was.
Sure.
But what was the culture like for you? You were in it. You've been out of it for a while. What, looking back, what was something that was most important to you looking at that culture that you try to bring to others?
Gosh, that's a great question. I probably, the thing that comes to mind right away is employees first, right? The idea was, you know, that you probably remember the motto was, we're ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. And when we, you know, when we operated the hotel, it was always about, are we taking care of the employees first? Because we cannot expect them to provide world-class service to our guests if we're not providing them a world-class employee experience. So down to the details of, you know, we had these blue mats at the front door of the hotel with the Ritz-Carlton Lion logo in it. But we also had the same blue mats at the employee entrance because we wanted that arrival experience for our employees to be safe. When we did inspections of the hotel, we always started in what was called the heart of the house, not the back of the house, but the heart of the house, which, again, a subtle change, but it says everything about how a hotel operates, right? It's the beating heart is the kitchen and the laundry, and, you know, those areas that are, they're often the unsung heroes of any hospitality business. And so we would start by making sure the heart of the house was spotless. And only then would we focus our attention on public areas and so on. So it kind of tells you everything you need to know about the culture. The empowerment is what also sticks in my mind. We had a rule, if you like, that every employee was empowered to the tune of $2,000 to solve any problem for the guest. Now, this was genius, right?
I mean, remember your story. Now we've heard things like, were they allowed to, or was there a certain checklist that they had to go through?
No, we're brutal. There may have been checklists when Marriott came along. Probably say that, but no, it was a real thing. It wasn't lip service. It was a real thing. And I think what was remarkable about it is that people knew it, people believed it, and because they believed it, their behavior changed. But in fact, they rarely needed the $2,000 to do anything. It was more about just being able to take care of guests and knowing that there was no fear of retribution if you did something special for a guest. You know, Mr. Schulze's philosophy on that is very clear, which was that if you look at the lifetime value of a guest, right? It's typically, back then it was $1 million or more, or it's more today, of course. But so, you know, when you think about $2,000, of course you'd spend $2,000 to protect that guest. And yeah, it's a no-brainer, right? So I remember one example of he was a Supreme Court justice that had stayed in our hotel, had left the hotel, somehow got out of a taxi in DC and left his briefcase in the back. And he called the hotel and I happened to get that call, and he was in a complete panic. He was obviously about to go into session and needed his documents and so on. And I was able to figure out which taxi company and track down the driver and so on. And it costs $80, $100 to eventually get the bag to him. I still have a letter on his Supreme Court letterhead acknowledging that moment and how I kind of saved the day. And again, it wasn't about that. It was just that I knew I could do whatever I needed to. But there's another story of a lady, a housekeeper, who flew to Hawaii with a guest's laptop, dropped it off at the hotel and took the flight home the same night, didn't stay overnight in Hawaii. You know, there's a lovely kind of Ritz-Carlton folklore, if you want, but it's all legitimate, you know, it's not.
Yeah. You are obviously. I remember I was working at the hotels, and I was working at the Lowe's Miami Beach Hotel, and that's when everyone got the book from Ritz-Carlton. They're like, all right, all of you now have 1,000, not 2,000. You all have 1,000.
Right. Yeah. It was what it said rather than what it did. You know, it was how it made people feel. It made people feel safe to do whatever they needed to do to take care of a guest. And, you know, that was more of a mindset than it was about the accounting transactions or the controls in place to monitor it. So yeah, it's you know, I have the absolute utmost respect for them. I think Marriott came in with a different view, more commercially minded in terms of where the brand should go. And I think we've seen that expansion under their leadership. But, you know, I like to reflect back on the early days when we had a small team that were really, you know, pioneers, mavericks in terms of service culture. And, you know, like you said, there's the people are studying it to this day. There's the Ritz-Carlton Leadership Academy that was established back then, where people can come and really learn all about it to see if they can apply it on their business.
Yeah, it's one of those brands, like you said, it's the folklore. That and Disney, I feel like, have those two.
Absolutely.
Were two stories that everyone hears about. But so you're doing with Carlton, you seem to be doing well. You're moving up in the hotel world. You come from a hotel family. And then all of a sudden, this interesting change happens. It seems like the high seas call.
That's right.
We're looking at the ocean maybe one day. What happens? What, tell the listeners here, what is this transition that you make?
So in 2001, I was approached by a friend of mine who's an executive recruiter in New York. He said to me, I've got this amazing opportunity for you. And of course, you know, recruiters are good salespeople, if nothing else. So yeah, they never say, I've got this lousy opportunity. It's always an amazing opportunity, right? So So I said, okay, tell me about it. And he said, you know, don't you want to get out of operations? Don't you want your weekends back? Would you like a Monday to Friday job? I said,
okay, yes, yeah, sure.
You've got my attention. And he said, I asked him, where would this job be based? And he said, it's in Miami. I said, okay, now you've really got my attention. He said, you'd be responsible for 12 business units, but it's going to grow aggressively. In fact, they want to bring people in now to kind of lock down their service standards and their, you know, the way they do things before they grow, because a lot of brands get that wrong, right? And dilute their brands when they do so. So I said, sounds amazing. You know, which hotel company are we talking about? And he said, actually, it's a cruise line. And I said, oh, no, sorry, you've got the wrong guy. That's not me. You know, it's funny, at the time, as a hotel person, we kind of looked down our nose, quite frankly, at the cruise industry. It was never something I would consider either personally for vacation at the time or certainly professionally. But he was coercive. He got me to fly down to Miami, do an interview, a couple of interviews with, gosh, Maria Sastre here in Miami, and Patrick Irons. I went on board a ship that day, saw the product for the first time, and was just intrigued. I was intrigued by the complexity of how they achieve so much. You know, I used to think hotels were complicated, but until I started to understand how ships operate. So that was the beginning of a pivot maybe in my career, where I went deep into cruise. I moved, the company was Royal Caribbean, and I moved to Miami as the corporate director of guest services, responsible for what was initially, I think, 13 ships, but we were quickly at 20 ships. We were growing very quickly. And I just had this amazing experience of understanding how to bring a lot of that experience from hotels and bring it to cruise. At the time, cruise was evolving, and there was a desire to bring people from the hotels and resorts world into cruise to make sure that the experience was more resort-like, because ultimately that's what cruises are competing with, right? It's against the theme parks, the Orlandos, the Disneys, but also the kind of big resorts. And so they said, if we're going to compete, we need to understand how to create an experience that's equivalent to that. And so a lot of what we did was to say, how can we move cruising, you know, maybe make it a little bit more contemporary as an experience, and make sure it's comparable and competitive with what you could have in a resort.
Really like making that change, right? Because it's a very different world from having, you go to walk in the hotel, you're at the corporate office in Buckhead, you got Horst Schultze parking his car every day, to then coming down to Miami. At a time when Miami was starting to boom, that was kind of like the hottest time of Miami at that time.
That's right.
And Royal Caribbean, really, that was like when I started seeing them change significantly, right? The bigger ships and more, like you're saying, more resorts. What was it like for you? Was it culture shock when you arrived, or was it like, oh, I get this. This is starting to, I got this.
Yeah, it was definitely in the deep end, no pun intended. And it's, you know, you think you know your way around hotels, and then you go look at a ship and you realize you don't know where it starts, right? I mean, it really was quite a challenge to understand the operations. I was fortunate to be, you know, kind of exposed to a new building environment, which is a new ship, quite early on. And that was formative for me, because I went and spent a month on board that ship and really was deep in the operation myself, like actually running parts of the operation with the leadership team. And that helped me really kind of understand how to unlock the full potential of the team and all of that. But I was only 6 months in Miami and 6 months in the cruise industry when 9/11 happened. Of course, that was the most catastrophic event that had ever impacted not just the world, but as a cruise industry, people stopped traveling overnight. And so it changed the industry dramatically. It was a time, we feared for our jobs. We feared for our safety. I mean, it was, right, we all remember those dark days. And what it forced us to do was relook at how fleets were deployed, right? So you know, ship deployment, people were no longer going to get on an airplane to go on a cruise, but they would get in their car. So suddenly you saw this kind of spread of ships from everywhere, from kind of Vancouver, Seattle, all the way down to LA and Ensenada. And then on the East Coast from kind of, you know, Boston to Miami, right? And into the Caribbean. And suddenly it became a dry-up market, which persisted for a number of years and I think has shaped how ships are now positioned into those markets, at least in summer months. So yeah, just to weather that storm and to come out the other side was a remarkable experience. The cruise industry has grown a lot. At the time, Royal Caribbean were, I don't know if you'll remember this, but the kind of theme song was Iggy Pop at the time, Lust for Life. The brand slow, or the tagline for the brand was Get Out There. And it was really, they were trying to get people to come to cruise who would never consider it. And they were trying to show that cruise is not the image you have in your head. You know, it's not sitting on a deck chair with a blanket over your legs, falling asleep, reading a book, playing shuffleboard, and so on. can be like that if you choose to have it like that, but it's also an incredibly active holiday. And of course, we know what happened next, right? The industry followed, but they were really the pioneers in showing the innovation of what could be done on a ship. At the time, they were introducing rock climbing walls, ice skating rinks, you know, things that would be just impossible. These days, it's almost, the question is almost like, what can't you do on a ship, right? Because
I've seen
so many of the other brands now follow suit and bring these innovations to
see. Not the main. And so as we're doing this, right, as I want to kind of touch base on where you're at. So when you were in Ritz-Carlton, you're more of a rooms guy, right? You're doing rooms.
Yes, I was.
You're doing these things. But as you start growing in Royal Caribbean, something interesting starts happening. You start to run food and beverage in these places. Cool. How does that happen? Because usually you see like, all right, these rooms guys, they don't know. Like I'm a food and beverage guy. I came up through food and beverage. I was like, room guy doesn't know what he's doing. How did you start to get into that world? And this is a very different world than a hotel. Like on a busy day at my largest hotel, 800 rooms, I was doing thousands of covers, but not, you know, all day, every day where people don't leave, right? So yeah. How was that for you? Were you doing 150,000 covers, you said, of daily output? You were seeing 19 ships.
Yeah, it was remarkable. I remember my hotel days as the rooms exec, I used to make fun of the F&B. I used to say, you know, for every dollar you make, we get to keep 30 cents. For every dollar I make, we get to keep 90 cents or whatever, you know. So I was kind of like, you're just the, you know, the lipstick here, the makeup, but
we're the artist here.
Exactly. We're the engine driving the revenue. So cruises, of course, a very different environment. It's all inclusive. I wasn't fully responsible for F&B. I was part of the F&B team, but I was responsible for what we call dining services back then. It was also kind of the advent of specialty dining on ships. That was kind of a new idea. Again, it seems like a distant memory now. And, you know, you wouldn't dare introduce a ship today without multiple dining options, right? So, but it was a time when dining was becoming less mass produced and less kind of banquet style and more a la carte, more specialized. And that was amazing because we got to shape concepts. We got to, you know, design and implement concepts either on new ships as they were delivered or even going back and retrofitting concepts when we did a dry dock for a ship. And that was amazing because it was almost like running a small business inside a business. You were fully managing the life cycle of conceptualization, design, the build, the outfitting, the FF&E, you know, the whole process down to opening it, training for it, and getting it up and running, operating it, tweaking it, fine-tuning it until it's, you know, humming and meeting its targets and all of that. And, you know, there's not many businesses where you get to come in and own the full life cycle like that. There were, of course, many experts involved along the way. We had a design team. We had, architects, naval architects, all of that. But to be consulted in each step, you really felt like you were shaping what these concepts would become. So that was an amazing time. I got to work with some amazing leadership. Frank Weber comes to mind. Frank is currently at Virgin Voyages. He and I knew each other when he was on ships initially. And then he was VP of Food and Beverage at Royal. During my time there, I got to work with Michael Bailey, who's currently the president of Royal, Richard Fain, who has just released a book that I bought 2 days ago, which I'm very excited to read. So yeah, it felt like, you know, that they were and are, you know, some of the most respected leaders in the industry. And I you know, in hindsight, it was a real privilege to get to be part of that team at that time because it felt like we were doing very special things. I've been out of Royal since 2008, but I continue to be one of their biggest fans, biggest admirers. I watch their every move, and I think they can kind of do no wrong. You know, they're an incredible powerhouse brand that continues to deliver these amazing experiences for their guests. So it's cool to be able to look back and say, I was part of that once upon a time, you know. So.
Yeah, and you're part of a very formative time because I remember going as a teenager in the 90s with my family. Right. I'm based here in Miami, and it has changed so much since the days where you had to like formally get dressed up and sit down at that banquet table and there was no other options to eat. If you didn't eat the Windjammer or you didn't eat in the banquet area.
Yeah. You were also told when to eat, right? You had your assigned dining time and whether you were hungry or not, that was your dinner time, right?
Well, we were people you didn't know at around to the round tables, all right? Which was part of the excitement too. And also some, you know, I get to meet a lot.
Hard to imagine now, right? It seems like we're so far from that. It's evolved so much since then, But there was a certain romance to that too. I think that appealed to a lot of original cruisers, right? And there are still people out there today that look for that experience.
Yeah, I love taking my kid now on these cruises. And then Royal Caribbean is where we go. We had tried Disney and we go to Royal Caribbean. So Royal Caribbean, if you're listening, there, I get me back in there. I'm going on a great trip coming up. Yes. But I want to talk to this. So you end up being director of guest services. And I think for people just to realize, and for me, I wanted to always hear this from someone at your level is, there's so many ships. There's 21 ships that you're working with. You have 50,000 berths that are coming on these ships. There's so much that's happening. How do you manage something that big? And how do you kind of organize yourself? Like, I know that, you know, I work on a system now that our friend Isabel Porzlikansky has put me on, right, on EOS. Very structured. I love using it. But sometimes a lot of the companies have standards and SOPs, but they don't teach you how to be a great leader or manager a lot of the times. You have to figure it out. What was it for you?
People. The answer is the people, for sure. You know, when you come from, when I first came from hotels and working at a property level to be in a corporation, you had to quickly learn that you can't go and be the fixer. You can't go out there and deal with it yourself. You need to have a relationship with your teams on board where you can pick up the phone and get them to do things because of your relationship, and you can lean on that. So I quickly learned that it was, the priority was to get to know who my leadership teams were. So I spent a lot of time traveling to do that and to get to know them. You know, developing new leaders, kind of always looking for that succession plan, who's the next leadership team. And that was it. You know, honestly, the only way to do it was to pick up the phone and try and reason with them on why a change needed to happen, or to discuss with them why performance was not where it needed to be, but to be able to have an open, honest conversation with them, as opposed to just, you know, firing emails around and kind of playing a blame game. It was much more meaningful to engage with them directly. So, you know, every hospitality business is a people business. In fact, every business is a people business at the end of the day, right? And it is about people. And you can have all the AI you want, but I think people still want to interact with each other, right? That's definitely protected for the future. So, and I think it brought me a little bit into what became my passion, which was about how do we develop hospitality leaders? That's really kind of where I specialize today is making sure that every hospitality brand is constantly developing their current leadership team and also looking for that talent within their team who are eager to grow, and showing them the way and kind of giving them the tools to get there. So yeah, it was a fascinating experience. You know, 19 ships, you can't be everywhere at once, right? So you just had to be able to pick up the phone. There was a lot of conference calls, right? And this was pre-Teams, right? So we didn't get to see each other on the screen, but we got to hear each other. And yeah, it was just an exciting time to be part of that. And when a company's growing as fast as they were, the timelines were very real. So you had your next shift being delivered in 6 months' time, and another one 6 months behind that, for example. So you knew you had to have 150 leaders ready to go for that shit. And so you took them from your fleet, right? You cherry pick the talent from around the fleet, but you were creating all of these gaps. The idea was, okay, well, if we're going to create gaps, we better have people ready to step into those gaps. And that was where the succession planning became critical. It was something Ritz-Carlton had taught me as well, because they were really strong on that. They were also growing very aggressively. So yeah, just I was able to kind of transfer that knowledge and apply some of the same learnings in cruise. And it was how we kept up with the growth, basically, while not diluting the brand.
I love it. And you're doing so many things that it's really, you know, for listeners, you don't understand. If you haven't worked in this something this big, you have, you know, giant cities or towns that you're just floating around over, you know, to make sure everyone's safe and fed and everything's going well. So it's amazing. But you mentioned all of your kind of colleagues have moved up and are now senior leaders, but you make a decision, right? And you say, all right, I want to start something of my own.
Yeah.
How did this happen? Because there's so many listeners now, you know, like they come to me and say, Steve, like you were on your way. Like, what happened? Why did you make a change? And I have my story. What is yours? Because it's something that not everyone is capable of doing. And you've been doing it for 17 years. How did you make that change?
Great question. I took the leap into the entrepreneurial world about 17 years ago. I was 35 years old at the time. Honestly, and frankly, I'd had enough of the corporate politics. I felt like this is an amazing business. And I felt like I knew now enough about it to be able to potentially go and help brands with some of the things I knew how to do. And the thought of being my own boss was very appealing. The thought of building my own team and kind of finding my own talent and growing my team was really exciting. It still is. And so, yeah, I took that leap, decided to start my own business in 2008. It coincided with us moving from Miami to Cape Town, South Africa. We had visited there on holiday or on vacation 1 year. My wife was born there, and so that's what brought us there. But we got to Cape Town, and I just said, oh my God, you kind of undersold it. This is the most amazing city I've ever visited in my life. And that's been home for us. That's where we live. That's where we've raised a family there. It's definitely what I consider my adopted home at this stage. And it's a great place to base this business because we are in the European time zone. You know, it's an easy overnight flight to get into London or anywhere in Europe, for that matter. And our day overlaps with the US. So we work quite a lot with the North American clients, but also predominantly European clients. And that allows us to, these days, right, we're doing a lot of work remotely. But the cruises industry requires travel. So I do spend a lot of time on the road visiting with clients. As I said, I'm in Miami this week and so on. And I'll be in Italy next week. So there's always something on the go. And you can't develop people without being in the room with them, I always think. So, you know, that part is still going to happen. You got to look them in the eye and be able to spend the time with them. So it's 17 years old now. We have a global team of trainers that deploy our leadership programs around the world. I'm very fortunate to have a really talented team of kind of independent contractors that support our programs. Isabel being one of them, of course. And it's been a real journey. We've partnered with some of the leading hospitality brands in the world. We do kind of two primary things. One is we build leadership programs that are bespoke to the brand. So if you have a large brand and you feel like your leadership teams are not on the same page, that's where we step in. We come in, we understand your business, we understand your DNA, what makes you unique. We craft a leadership program around that. We train all of your current leadership teams on that program so that the behavior that's expected of every leader is crystallized, super clear. And we make sure that every new leader, whether promoted internally or brought into the business as new talent, is equally up to speed on those behaviors. So suddenly everybody's rowing in the same direction. Suddenly it's quite a powerful impact to have your leadership teams at every level, in every property or on every ship, kind of super aligned on what the brand promise is and doing what they need to do to get there. So that's our leadership side of our business. And then on the service side, we're experts in service culture. A lot of it is shaped on what I've described to you in the last while here. You know, my Ritz-Carlton days and even back to my days in our family business, I've always, I grew up, it was kind of a part of my upbringing to learn how to take care of people. And that's how I found myself in this business. And I like to think we can now help other brands do that too. You know, there's a fabulous story of John F. Kennedy walking into NASA, in the decade in the 60s when he said, we're going to put a man on the moon. And he was doing a visit and he said to one of the janitors, what are you doing here? What's your role? And he said, I'm here to put a man on the moon while he mopped the floor. And that's kind of our view of what we'll do for your brand. We'll come in, we'll make sure that every single person, no matter if it's a line cook, a laundry attendant, an engineer, a plumber, it doesn't matter. We're going to make sure they all understand how they contribute to what your brand promises to your guests and how they play a critical part. So we build these branded customer service programs. We roll that out. We do these activations with property levels or ship levels, depending whether it's a hotel company or a cruise line. And it's amazing to see people just get behind that, get excited about it. It reminds me of hotel openings back in the day where people were so passionate and so eager to get those, kick those doors open and start trading. So it's been a very exciting journey. We've had the opportunity to work with some of the leading brands in both hotels and cruise. We're still growing as a business. We're small but mighty, I like to think. A small but dynamic team. We're very passionate about what we do. We believe in staying the course. We don't consider ourselves consultants because I believe that's the C word. You know, that's a kind of a negative connotation for me. It's about, we partner with our clients. It's not a service provider, it's a partnership, right? We have a real longstanding relationship with our clients and we stay the course with them until we get them to where they want to be. So either to kind of solidify their world-class position or get them to where they become world-class. And that's what we found ourselves doing for these last 17 years. And
I love it. I think one of my questions, right? Because I think people now out there hear this and they're, you know, for the brands, I'm sure you have this all the time. You said, we're not consultants, right? Because they're saying, I don't know. I don't want a consultant. There's an outsider coming into my culture, right? Yeah. So how do you, if you work with some of these biggest brands in the world, and I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say which ones, but maybe you can, because I've heard of where some of my friends that work with you go to and they're on these world-class places. How do you convince them that they need your training? They're already the top of the game. Why do they need your help?
Yeah, that's a great question. The opportunity for any of us in leadership positions in a hospitality business, we know that if our team are on the same page and have a clear understanding of what we're all trying to accomplish, then you know, everything goes well. If you have a great team that's completely activated, empowered, trusted, energized, motivated, everything is possible. Conversely, if you don't, everything is impossible, right? So we like to think that if there's clarity around what's expected, then you're going to see the results. You're going to see people get passionate about it. And just this week, we were introducing a new service program with one of our clients, which is Princess Cruises. And I got to present to captains of 47 years, of general managers of 36 years in the business and so on. And to see their excitement about a new service program that kind of crystallizes what that brand is all about was incredibly rewarding. They came up to us afterwards and thanked us for work we've done, and really, really powerful to see them get behind it. We've had similar experiences with Viking. We've been working with Viking Cruises now for 11 years this year. And what a story that's been. I mean, I'm so incredibly proud to be associated with that brand. They are pioneers. They're super clear on who they are and who they're not. And they execute that flawlessly around the world every day. And, you know, I've joined them when we started the Ocean Project, building ocean ships for the first time for just these reasons, to build service programs and leadership programs. And those programs have gone on to win awards, and I'm really proud just to have had a small part to do with that. So yeah, it's been an amazing journey. I would do it all again tomorrow. I love what I do. It takes me around the world. I get to work with amazing industry professionals. And yeah, I'm excited to see what the future holds and where it will take us next.
We'll talk about that before we get to wrap this up here. I'm not asking for your 5-year business plan here, but what are you most excited about in the next 12 months? What are you most excited?
Absolutely. We are eager to do more work in traditional hospitality. We want to partner with some of the world's leading hotel brands to be able to take some of this knowledge and share it with them. The hotel business is more complex today than ever before. I think everybody realizes that post-COVID, we took a hit. It's a challenging time to recruit people. If you look at kind of the workforce, there's 5 generations working in the hospitality industry or any industry for the first time. And the way you lead somebody who's Gen Z versus Gen X or a boomer is very different, or a millennial, right? So you know, part of what we do is we equip your leaders with tools on how to do that effectively. And that's super exciting to me, because it's about, you know, what got you here isn't going to get you there, right? So we've got to make sure that we're constantly equipping leaders with the tools they need to be effective today and tomorrow, not yesterday, right? So it's really about making sure we're providing them with meaningful stuff. I have leaders come up to me when we complete our programs and they're like, wow, I can go use this today. This is real. You know, this is not some abstract consulting speak. These are practical tools that you can walk into your business and implement immediately. And what we try to do is simplify them and make them so actionable that people kind of like, I wish I had known this sooner, you know, and they just can implement it easily. Yeah. And that's been really rewarding just to see that. So we want to do more of that. We want to grow. We believe there's an opportunity in the world of safaris based on being in Cape Town. Of course, it's a hub for that. So we're excited to transfer that knowledge into the world of safaris. We're excited to take it into luxury hotel companies and really kind of share a lot of what's worked really well for us. I think over time, hospitality has come to respect the cruise industry as well. So, you know, there's an openness now that maybe there wasn't before to how can we learn from cruise ships.
Yep.
There's a rigor and discipline with cruise ships that a lot of hotels would love to have. And I think we can help transfer that knowledge as we grow. So yeah, that's what the future holds. Those are our plans. And we're busy working on that over the next 12 months at least.
Yeah. I love it. That's amazing to hear all the fun things that you have coming up. I want to ask you one last question, Dara, here.
Sure.
So if you could go back to young Dara mowing the lawn in Ireland and whisper in his ear some advice about his hospitality career, of all the things you know now, what are you whispering into young Dara's ear as he's just thinking about life, mowing that lawn?
Yeah. You know, maybe the old tagline of Royal Caribbean applies right here. Maybe it's get out there, right? I've been really fortunate to get to do some amazing things in my career. I haven't always leapt at them. I've always been kind of measured and maybe play pretty low risk in terms of how I approach the next thing. It makes me wonder what opportunities I've missed, you know, sometimes. Not to say that I'm not grateful for where we are. So I would just say get out there. You know, it's a time to experience the world. We work in an amazing business, right? You get to do some amazing things. People are typically enjoying themselves and having fun when they're in our environments. And to get to curate that and shape that and see that look in people's eyes when they're having a great time is just incredibly rewarding. So yeah, I would tell myself to get out there, maybe get off the lawn more and get moving quicker. God knows where I would have been.
That's great advice. I think it's a good way to end our show here. I can't believe time flew by so quickly here chatting with you. But listeners and viewers, if you found some value in this, like I know I did, make sure to pause this, hit that share button that's right here on the screen or on your phone, and send this to a friend of yours, because Dara just shared so much great advice with us and so many great stories. And so Dara, if somebody wants to join with or join you or connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that? Is that on LinkedIn or is there another way you want?
Absolutely. So the cool thing about my name is you will only find one of me on LinkedIn. There is only one Dara McGillicuddy out there. Our company is McGillicuddy Hospitality. Our website is exactly that, McGillicuddyHospitality.com. Reach out, get in touch. We'd love to talk. We'd love to hear from you and continue the conversation. So absolutely, yes. Thank you.
I'm very grateful you spent this time with me. I know how busy you are traveling the world and here in Miami. Next time, whenever we're going to make it happen, we're going to meet in person. I appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's been an honor. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by Biscayne Coffee. Biscayne Coffee was founded with a giving spirit and a big idea to enjoy delicious coffee roasted in Miami while helping save Biscayne Bay and the animals that live there. As a former food and beverage director, I can assure you these are some of the best quality beans on the planet. 10% of every coffee sold is donated to nonprofits to help preserve Biscayne Bay for all to enjoy. Visit BiscayneCoffee.com today and use promo code MENTOR at checkout to save 10% on your first order. Drink good coffee and create a good outcome.